This is a birthday episode for the famed novelist James Jones, who turns 99 today. James Jones's debut novel, From Here to Eternity, was published in 1951 and received the 1952 National Book Award. What most people didn't know when they read the novel in 1951 was that there were some incredibly truthful references taken out of the book because his editor feared it wouldn't get past the censors or be delivered by the U.S. Postal Service. In 2011, the book was re-released digitally, unexpurgated, after his daughter Kaylee struck a deal with Open Road Media to publish the book. Now, millions can read the novel as Jones intended it to be read, honest, raw, and authentic to the experiences of average rank-and-file soldiers stationed in the South Pacific during World War II. My conversation with Jones' daughter got me thinking about censorship in general, and how it can still plague us in the 21st century, and we talked about that a little bit. So meet the new boss, same as the old boss. Here's my conversation with the novelist and publisher Kaylee Jones on the day her dad turned 99. We're talking to Kaylee Jones, daughter of James Jones, famous American novelist. He turns 99 today, actually. Can you, is it hard for you to imagine that your dad is going to be 99? It's hard for me to imagine my dad would have, is closing in on 80 if he was around.
It's very difficult. I'm now 4 years older than my, 5 years older than my father was when he died. And, you know, in my mind, he's still the same age. He's still, you know, 55 years old. And, you know, I mean, he probably would never have made it to 99, no matter what, you know, with the health and the war and malaria and everything else. But it's so amazing because almost all of that generation are now gone, you know, so it's.
Do you think about, on days like today, do you think about his birthday when it comes around, or like?
I think about it every year. And yeah. I usually post something about it, and I think about him all the time, especially around the anniversary of his death and the anniversary, you know, and his birthday and their wedding anniversary, my parents' wedding anniversary. Yeah, no, it never really goes away, and yet he's frozen in time, you know.
Yeah.
Excuse me.
I can feel that. I have my father was 61 when he died, and the same thing. Like, I don't even age him in my mind. Like, I just close my eyes and I can picture still a guy in his like late 50s, you know, early 60s, the last time he was.
Yes. And that's, and I, you know, one time I was visiting, Aaron and I were visiting colleges. We were visiting University of Texas at Austin, and we were walking down the street. I'd just taken her to the Ransom Center, and the librarian pulled out all these documents to show her of my father's, and she was really very moved by that because he came alive in these photos and letters, and we were walking down the street and she said, "Mommy, if he walked by right now, would he recognize us?" And it caught me so off guard. It was such a longing in her, and in such a kind of such an emotional thing that she said. And I said, yes, of course he would recognize us. And then I thought about it for the next few days, thinking like, would he recognize me? Am I anything like the person that he knew, the kid that he knew? I was 16 when he died.
Right.
You know, am I anything like what he imagined I would be? And I really don't know. I don't know. I hope so.
Yeah, I would hope so too. That is a trip to think about that. Like I would, you would think that as a parent, you would remember your own kid, even if you saw him 100 years later.
You know? Yes.
But yeah,
I think so. There is a connection, no question.
Yeah.
You know, with one parent or the other, and sometimes both. But yes, I think that, and I wonder. I mean, for me, the saddest thing is all the books on the shelves that were in our house. Every book, every wall was a bookcase practically in our house. And in my room were the leftovers, the books, the paperbacks he couldn't fit in the other rooms. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I didn't develop an interest in really reading seriously till I was a little older. And, you know, I only discussed a few books with him, not many books with him. And I remember the discussions we had about books better than I remember almost anything about, you know, those last few years of his life. And now I think of all the books that I've now read that he had on the shelves that, you know, took me years to work my way through.
Yeah.
And I think to myself, like, gosh, why? I wonder what he would say about this, or I wonder what he would say about that kind of thing, you know?
Right. Yeah. What was he into? What was he? Did he like the Russians? Was he a Joyce person? Or?
He read everything. He was sort of omnivorous as a reader, and he studied other writers. You know, he studied other writers to become a better writer. And sometimes he didn't understand how a writer pulled something off. And sometimes, if it was a living writer, he would write to that person and ask him or her, you know, how did you do that? What was interesting is he had a few very good female writer friends. Like, he was very good friends with Mary McCarthy. Mm. He was very good friends with Lillian Hellman. You know, there were, you know, at that time, they were sort of divided, you know, the feminists and the, you know, and if you were any kind of female writer who spoke up, you were considered a feminist, and then it wasn't such a good word, you know, and they really jumped on a lot of those female writers of that time. But he, you know, he didn't think that way. And, you know, I found Edith Wharton on the shelves in my mother's house, which surprised me. You know, years later, when I read Edith Wharton, I was stunned to see all the paperbacks, well read, well turned the pages. You know, he loved Edna St. Vincent Millay. He loved Emily Dickinson. I mean, it's interesting. He didn't just read, you know, the great old white American writers, you
right,
know?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was wondering what he thought of the Beats, because they were writing at the same time as him.
He didn't think very much of, I think he liked, as far as I remember, he liked Ken Kesey as a writer, and he didn't think very much of Kerouac's writing style.
Yeah.
You know, he kind of thought, like, what a waste of time to go get totally wasted and you know, go on the road. It was always an interest of his romantically, you know, to go hit the road and, you know, go travel and, you know, do that stuff. But he didn't have time. He had to write. And he thought he was a slow writer, you know, that he needed a lot of time and a lot of quiet. Mostly it was about quiet for him.
Right. Yeah. Oh, I can relate to that.
Yeah. And it was tough because, you know, they also were very popular and were invited to all these parties, and, you know, they held a salon on Sunday nights at our house. And so he, you know, you know, it was hard for him to find the quiet he needed to really write. Yeah.
Yeah. His, and he's probably one of the rare cases where his debut novel, From Here to Eternity, it was published in 1951 and it received the National Book Award, right? It was his debut.
Yep. It was his first novel. Yeah.
To win the National Book Award on your first time out, it's pretty amazing. But what most people don't know is that when they read the novel in 51, they probably didn't realize that he was involved in a pretty intense battle with his publishers, who insisted on censoring some of the languages and the references.
In the book. Very much so. And, you know, there's a book of letters that was put together by Dr. George Hendrick. He's one of his biographers, and he put together a book of all the letters, my dad's letters. And there's a whole section on censorship and on the letters he wrote to Scribner's. You know, at the time it was Burroughs Mitchell was his editor after Maxwell Perkins died in the middle of the writing of From Here to Eternity. You know, Perkins died and he was handed over to Burroughs Mitchell, who was young, who was had been an officer in the war. He'd been in World War II as an officer, though, you know, he was stunned. Mitchell was stunned by the language and by the sexual obsessions, you know, of the soldiers, and kept you know, trying to cut the language, cut the fuck out, the words out, and certainly the C word out, and many of the sexual reference, the homosexual sexual references, and so on. And he really, you know, did a first edit. My father was so upset by it. He wrote him a letter saying, you know, and broke down why he disagreed and why he thought that this was absolutely wrong to do. And he said, you know, you were an officer, he said to him, you didn't know what it was like as what the soldiers were really like when nobody else was around. And I want this to be realism. I want it to sound and feel the way it really was. I don't want to write a cleaned up version, you know, of what it really was about. And I'm using the language that was used by the soldiers. I'm not making it up. And I think people automatically assumed that he was exaggerating or that this wasn't the way it was, but it really was that way.
So Mitchell made these changes to the book without even consulting your dad about it? He just went ahead?
Yeah, he just edited. You know, he went through.
Is that a common practice?
Yes, editors just edit, and then you go back and you might argue about certain things and say, well, I don't like this. I want it back the way it was. You know, you can do that. And there was another level another issue here, which is the United States Post Office would not mail anything that they considered purient or obscene or you know salacious or whatever. They just would not mail the books. And if the post office refused to mail the books, there would be no way to get the book out at that time. And so that was an issue. Like, how much could they get away with before they would be censored by the United States Post Office? So that was another issue that they finally, the lawyer for Scribner's finally made some, you know, figured out exactly how much they could have in there. And so they did have to cut. And that was really difficult for him to cut spots where.
Yeah. Whose decision was that at the post office? See, there's some postal workers making.
Who knows? I don't know which department it is. I don't really know. I mean, we could go look that up. I'm not sure, but I know that it was a question at one point of getting it through the censors, you know, government censors of the United States Post Office. And that was a big, big, big issue at the time.
So a famous quote from your father too, that editor in that letter, I think it was in that letter you're talking about, right? Was what he said, the things we change in this book, the things we change in this book for propriety's sake will in 5 years or 10 years come in someone else's book anyway. That was his kind of reaction to it. And he was probably right. He was much more forward thinking maybe than he's possibly given credit for when it came to that. Like knowing that, you know, the Overton window is going to move, right? The what we're willing to accept is going to change.
He was very prescient in so many ways, and that for a 29-year-old, you know, is pretty extraordinary. That thinking forward about what would change, and if you think about what is on TV even now, you know, regular television, what is what people hear and see, you know, it's it's truly amazing. I mean, he was sort of way ahead of the 60s, you know, way ahead of the sort of big movement that came after of freedom, you know, sexual freedom and freedom of language, you know, everything that happened after the 50s. This was, again, remember, it was 1950, 1951. That's pretty amazing, you know, and he just wanted it to be truthful, you know, his experience, but truthful in his memories and what he recorded in notebooks, what he lived through. And, you know, to clean it up to him, he thought was a sin, you know, to make it cleaner, to make it more palatable to the general public, you know, was wrong. And it was the first novel to use the F word, you know, in print. Hemingway used fug, F-U-G, other people used other things, but, and he was going back and looking for examples of, like he used Molly Bloom as an example, you know, and said, you know, but again, that book was censored. So, but, you know, the masterpieces that broke all the rules and addressed sexual issues or language or, you know, even what was considered deviant, people pushed the line, kept pushing the line. And sometimes they would be censored and sometimes it would get through. And, you know, some of those books are considered like just so forward and, you know, so forward thinking. So I think, I mean, he believed in things that, and I don't know where this came from, if it was just a thought he had or if it was based on research. I mean, if he was interested in something, he would go and he would read everything he could find on it. I think that's one of the interesting aspects of autodidacts, people who are completely self-taught, is that, you know, they pursue a subject like, you know, all the way. Like, he would just go get all the books he could on that subject. And one thing that really interested him was the universe. And, you know, were there, you know, the idea that we were the only planet in the entire universe that had life on it was something that he absolutely refused to believe. And he said, one day they're going to find, you know, other planets circling suns, you know, that can support life. Whether or not they can find life is another matter, but they will find other solar systems that function like ours that have planets that could support life. And this was something that was so not at all what people were thinking at that time. You know, what was really, things like that, that really, you know, that he thought, and when we, you know, I think it was 1990 or 1999, around then, I don't remember, maybe 1999, when the first for sure planet that fit all the criteria was discovered, you know, by astronomers. You know, I cried that day.
Yeah.
I was so stunned that I couldn't believe it, that happened, and that he never would know that, you know?
Yeah, did he want to kind of go head to head with the censors, or did he want to break ground with them, or do you think it just, this situation came up and caught him kind of blindsided? And then I guess my follow-up question would be like, ultimately, why did he acquiesce? Did he acquiesce just because, you know, I mean, I would acquiesce, especially if I'm a debut novelist, you know, but like, what ultimately, why did he back down? Did he?
Well, if he didn't back down completely, he backed down a little bit. He backed down as much as he had to in order to have the book published.
Book published, right.
Yeah. Otherwise it wouldn't have been published. And I think it was too important to him. Yeah. And that he figured, you know, sometime down the line, you know, this can be revisited maybe, or something like that. But I met some of his friends from his hometown of Robinson, where he went back after the war. And one of his friends, she and her husband, the two of them were his friends. He plopped the manuscript down on the kitchen table and said, and it was huge, you know, and he said, all right, we have to cut this many F words from the manuscript. And they went page by page and would read the sentence and try to find other ways of saying the same thing. And she said it was hilarious because it took them days and days, and he resisted on so many of them and was like, there is no other way to say this. So then they'd find another one to cut instead. And they went line by line, like fine tooth comb through the whole manuscript to get it down to the number that the lawyer said would be acceptable, you know, for the post office at that time. The other thing that's interesting is that the veterans, you know, both, you know, I'd say mostly the soldiers, you know, that fought in the war, but I'd say probably Navy guys too. I'm not sure, you know, how, but let's say just the guys that were on the ground, you know, in the war.
Yeah.
All bought the book and read the book and loved the book. That's why it was a bestseller. That generation and the wives, you know, and the children of those people really wanted to know what it was like. And this was the truest account that they had, you know, that was available, you know, at the time.
Explain real quick, just for people who don't know, that like what were the sexual references that were in the book that everybody took issue with?
Well, there's in the same letter that you were just reading from, there's the word, the C word, right, which he used, and that had to go. They couldn't keep it, but they very easily called like the pinup calendars and posters they had. I'm trying to remember exactly what the term was, but he said, you know, we're not calling anybody the C word. This is what we called those posters that everybody had, those calendars of pinup girls, you know? And he said, they wouldn't let it through. So that, you know, things like that. Then there was a pretty descriptive and very sort of very blunt and honest portrayal of the soldiers, you know, these, first of all, this crew, these guys before the war, we're talking about From Here to Eternity, before the war, they were really like one step up from homeless. You know, this was like a generation of kids, you know, from the Depression who had nothing. They had nothing. They had no future, no hope. So they joined the army, and the army was hard and rough, and they were considered very, very much like bums. You know, people would stay away from them because they were, you know, they were the lowest rung of society at that point before the war started. I'm talking about in Hawaii, for example. And, you know, the soldiers had no money and nothing. And it was not at all rare or considered weird, you know, for soldiers to go to the gay bars. And there were sort of hidden gay bars in Waikiki, pick up a guy, get $50 to, you know, have sex with them. Yeah. And then they would have enough money to go to the whorehouse, which is what they really wanted to do, go drinking, you know?
Yeah,
and
even so they themselves were straight, they would engage in this.
They were completely straight, you know, or at least like, he had another thing that I thought was incredible about him too is he had absolutely no issues with homosexuality. He had a lot of friends who were gay at the time who were somewhat out, you know, somewhat publicly gay that, you know, when I was growing up, and he admired their courage because that was really rare that people would be open. And he really admired that they stood for something and that they were in long-term relationships, and he didn't see any reason why they couldn't be together or be married or that there was any, you know, so he had a very interesting, and he also thought that sexuality was a spectrum, that you could be both. You could like men and women. You could still be straight and be interested in sexual relationships with men. He really believed that. And he writes about that in The Thin Red Line too. You know, there are two soldiers who engage in a relationship in The Thin Red Line. And that is written in the most non-judgmental way, very objective way. In From Here to Eternity, a lot of the soldiers did that. And that was, nobody talked about it because you didn't want to get caught, but it wasn't ever, they didn't think of it as anything weird. They thought of it as getting some money to go to the whorehouse, you know. And actually in From Here to Eternity, there is one character who is gay and who is very, very worried because he enjoys being with the gay guy that he spends time with too much. He ends up killing himself because he really feels this like shame about it in this terrible way. And he knows that the others don't feel the way he does when they're with the men. And, yeah. And that is where the line they drew, you know, we're not talking about a highly educated group of people here. You know, the line they drew was like, you know, I like women. I'm just doing this because I need money or whatever. Yeah. People really freaked out at that. And they ended up having to cut quite a bit of that out of the book.
Right. Yeah. That's the thing that's interesting is that the irony of it is that here your dad is telling the truth about something that many people experienced or were familiar with. And yet the publishers decided that it was better to print the lie, you know, by omission, right?
Exactly. By omission. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
And you know, the number, I this is something that has moved me all my life, all my adult life, the number of men my age, or maybe even a little older than myself, whose fathers were in the war, right? Who've come up to me at parties or at symposia or, you know, at dinners or wherever, have come up to me and said, I hear you're James Jones's daughter. Yes, yes, I am. Well, you know, my dad was at Bastogne. My dad was at, you know, Guadalcanal. My dad was at, you know, Iwo Jima, whatever. And he was a very tight-lipped about it. My dad never wanted to talk. And when I was young, I felt this great weight. And I would say, you know, Dad, what was it like? Mm-hmm. And at some point, you know, in their youth, their father handed them the Thin Red Line.
Yeah.
and from her returning and said, this is what it was like. This is, he told the truth. And that meant more to me in terms of, you know, that these young men found solace through the books from the, by osmosis, or I don't know how you would say it, but, you know, through my dad, for their father's wounds, for their father's psychological wounds and emotional wounds from reading these books. And so if he hadn't been honest about it, if they had cut everything out and made it all clean and, you know, taken out the heart of what he was trying to say, they wouldn't have been the same books.
Right, right. So that's, that answers my question, that why you felt the need to republish, but just to, you went ahead and you republished this book unabridged, right? With all the
at one point, this is in the early, in, I mean, after, I'm trying to remember exactly when, but this is maybe 10 years ago, maybe more, 11 or 12 years ago, Open Road Media got in touch with me. And that is, you know, Jane Friedman, who was, you know, the head of Crown and, you know, HarperCollins, really a wonderful woman. She called me up and said, what are the electronic rights for your dad's work? You know, and I said, we don't have any, because it was before there was any electronic books. And she said, well, we're starting a company and we really would like to publish, you know, have the rights to the electronic, you know, to the books. And I said, I have to go check, you know, let me go check and everything. My agent took over all of that and checked on everything. And then I said to her, you know, this isn't the actual version that my dad really wanted to publish. She said, what do you mean? She didn't even know about it.
Right.
And I said, well, you know, the original manuscript is full of edits and cuts due to censorship.
So you had the original manuscript, like, in your possession?
I don't own it, but it's at the Ransom Center. And, or no, it's not at the Ransom Center. It's the University of Illinois, I believe. I don't remember, but in any case, there is an original manuscript, and for reasons of, you know, scholarship, some of the people who worked on my dad's, you know, literary canon, I know that George Hendrick, I called George Hendrick and I said, you know, they would like to do this. Do you know which parts were the parts that he wanted in there and parts that were, you know, grammatical or, you know, those kinds of edits? He says, oh yeah, I know exactly. Oh, wow. And I said, well, can you fix this so that I can give that to Jane Friedman and it can be published as he wanted it published. So that's what we did. And he was a real expert. I got a call from another, you know, really big, like American Library, wanted to do their own original, you know, unexpurgated version. But the guy said to me, you know, that the publisher or the editor said, you know, I'm going to edit it. And I said, no, you see, that's the whole point, is that this has to be edited by, this has to be the way he wanted it. Otherwise there's no point in this. I want this to be the way he wanted it exactly. So we went with, you know, Jane Friedman and with Open Road Media, and the book was published as he wanted it, with all the homosexual stuff, the C word, the F words all put back in, everything that was taken out.
Wow. Yeah, that's amazing. So one of the interesting things that seems to be constant about the censorship, whether it's 20th century or 21st century, is that it seems to be handed down from like a handful of, I guess, what you call elite people, or the elite. Like in the 19th and 20th century, this concern was that obscenity or political dissent could be disseminated to the elderly and the lower classes. And what are we going to do about that? Well, during my research, I stumbled upon, you know, scholars who quoted from, you know, opinion articles saying that, like, well, the lower classes could find out about or get access to this. That's a horrendously elitist position. And now, in the 21st century, it seems like that's also the thinking, that we need to protect certain words and phrases, need to be shielded from people who aren't capable of thinking. What do you think? I guess it's a broader philosophical question, but like, what is that compulsion? Like, what is that need?
Well, it's exactly what you said, I think. And we're, you know, the soldiers that he was writing about were not the elite, you know, which is the point. They were the guys, they were the kids that, you know, were riding the trains. You know, one of the books I published by Lori Lowenstein is about the Depression and you know, these young men who were kicked out of their families because there were too many mouths to feed. And they said, you're off on your own, kid. We can't feed you anymore. And they would try to find jobs and they would go on the lam or on the bum. You know, they would go and jump trains and go across country. My dad did that for a little while. He hated it. He said, this isn't for me. I can't do this. You know, so he joined the army. Yeah. So that was who was in the army at that time, the regular army before the war. After Pearl Harbor, then suddenly the draft was reinstated. You know, a lot of people joined up on their own volition, you know, like just to, you know, out of outrage, like after 9/11, you know, but the guys that were already there were a bunch of hard, hard kids who had not gotten the education that they deserved, you know, had been hungry, had been cold, had worked really hard jobs. And the thing is, in the end, the truth is that they were a hell of a good fighting force. You know, they ended up calling that crew the Tropic Lightning Division because of the way they moved like lightning through the tropics. I mean, they were amazing. And they were hard. They were tough, you know. And I think that was really who he was writing about. And, you know, it's always been that way. Our armed forces are populated on that level, you know, by usually runs in families, you know, like one family will be Navy, one family will be Army. And, you know, depending on your level of education and your class, you know, you go in as an officer or you go in as an enlisted man, you know, the jump over is not that usual. It happened a lot in World War II because there were so many of these guys, like, you know, different battles. I've read a lot about the battles in World War II, not just in the Pacific, but, you know, the sergeant or the lieutenant would be shot, would die on the field. And one guy would stand up and go, okay, this is what we're going to do. Just because he had the incentive, because he had the smarts, because he was brave, and he would get a commission, right? He would move up and become, you know, and a lot of these guys moved up that way. We're not talking about the elite, you know, special forces or the Marines or the, you know, the parachutists, you know, we're talking really about the regular army, the regular grunts, you know, and he was really writing about them. And I think this is still true now. You still have, even here where I live, you know, I live in a compound where there are many Navy SEALs and many just enlisted Navy men with their families. And the SEALs look down on, you know, the other guys, and not because they're a higher class, but because they pass the hardest possible physical, you know, the really hardest physical tests you could possibly pass to become SEALs. And so they're the elite in this crew, you know, and that's not class so much as physical and mental strength, right. You know, but there is still a system, a hierarchy, a hierarchical system. I think that is absolutely elitist. Like, we don't want, same thing with education, make high school as, you know, don't teach people too much, teach them just enough. Right. Because if you teach them too much, then they're going to want to go to college. They're going to want to run the country, and they're going to be liberal. They're going to be socialist. They're going to be this or that. They're not going to protect the status quo. Right now, what's going on, it's all about protecting the status quo, protecting power, yeah. Keeping power in the hands of a very few. And I think that's what education has always been about, is too much education. I mean, that's what happened in Russia, you know, before the revolution, was a whole educated class of people that were intellectuals were, you know, sort of rising up again through the army, right? Through the ranks of the army, their kids went to college for whatever reason or went and became educated. They were the dangers. They're the ones who started the revolution, mm-hmm. You know, not the upper class, not the, you know, the nobility, and certainly not the peasants who for, you know, the 90% of the country couldn't read and write at all. You know, so.
You sound like a Marxist, Kaylee.
I am not a Marxist. I've never been. I don't believe in communism because I don't believe in censorship. Right. And communist, you know, all over the world, communist dictatorships censor people's ability to be free to explore their artistic temperament or their individuality, because it's not about individuality, right? Yeah. So I'm absolutely opposed to that.
Yeah, and that's one of the interesting things that you just said before was that you used the word power or control, and that's what I was going to ask you. Like, do you think this censorship is more about, even back when your dad got censored, like, is this more about control than it is about protection? Because this seems like the stand-in excuse for it all is like, well, we have to protect the innocent, we have to protect this person, we have to protect these people, but it to me, it seems like it's more about control. It's about a power grab than it is.
My, I don't know about this. And I've thought about this a lot, over the last, few years, you know, my dad thought it was about the Puritan ethic on which this country was built. He believed that the Puritans came from England and that they were extremely sexually repressed, that there was extreme sexual repression within that community. And that, even when they were talking about freedom of expression, freedom of religion, it really wasn't as free as they, you know, as they wanted it to be. I mean, that was an ideal, but that it was really more about sexual repression. And if you go to France or England, or, and I don't know about England, but if you go to France and you watch TV, the commercials for like body creams, women are bare-breasted. This is no big deal. You see a television, a crime show, and a man runs by naked, completely naked with his privates out. Nobody thinks a thing about that. Nobody freaks out. You know, like a cadaver will be naked and there you will see his sexual organs in European TV shows. Here, they cover it over. Mm. They, in every single show, they cover it over. They will not expose even a dead person. What is less sexy than a dead person, right? But in their minds, that's exposing whoever you're not supposed to expose to the genitals is, you know, a bad thing. So it's turned into something bad, even though really it doesn't even occur to people in Europe to cover up the genitals of a corpse, you know, in a television show. Do you see the difference in the thinking? So it's more about protecting people from sexual prurience or, you know, sexual exploration. You know, that is really, and the counterbalance to that is the extremes to which women are sexualized on television or in books even, you know, so it will always swing the other way. If you repress, it will always go too far the other way, which is what causes all, you know, my dad, you know, in Some Came Running, it's all about, you know, what you see, what goes on in the society. Everybody goes to church, everybody's married, everybody's happy. Isn't it great? And on, you know, Friday nights, Saturday nights, they sneak off to Terre Haute, to the whorehouses or to their mistresses or to who, there's a whole under, it's almost as prevalent as the black market was in Russia during communism. Everything was there and you didn't know how anybody got it, but it was all done through the black market. This is the same idea. It's like this underworld, I mean, it's ridiculous, that people were forced to go that way because in regular society, you couldn't even have a relationship with somebody if you weren't married. You know, if you weren't going to church every Sunday, you were bad. You know, everything within that was like being in a fish tank. The whole country, and I'd say especially in the West and in the Midwest, you know, and the Southern states, that kind of very rigid Protestantism, you know, has propagated this, you know, and people aren't even aware of it, you know, I think in some ways.
Yeah, no, because I would think that our culture has gotten away from the religious Puritanism as about as far as you can, it seems to me, but yet that's still that like, it's almost like a religious need for that original sin. I don't even know how to explain it, but like that weird kind of cultural thing where we still feel compelled to create these sort of laws of propriety, you know, and maybe those are shifting. I don't know. But that's my question, is like, what do you think is like, what is the thing we need to look out for now in 2020 that smacks of Puritanism?
Well, I think the whole, I truly believe the whole Republican Party's lost its mind. You know, I really believe that this has nothing to do with religion per se, and everything to do with sexual. If I've lived my whole life this way, then you have to live your whole life this way too.
Yeah.
The kind of religious fanaticism that's taken over. Barry Goldwater talked about this, you know, 60 years ago, you know, like, what's going to get us is the Christian fundamentalists in this country who you can't talk to about anything because they're so sure that they're right, that you can't have any discussion on any level, you know. And I don't know that it's true that if you're exposed to sex, that you will become a deviant. I think if you're exposed to, you know, the objectifying of women, you know, then you might become a sexual deviant, but I don't think it's the sex itself. I think that's what people are confused about, what it is that they're against, what it is that they're opposed to.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think marriage between two homosexual people, in what way does that affect them? In what way does that ruin their life? I think the only way it ruins their life is if they're afraid that their child is going to be homosexual or that they're going to be homosexual, and that somehow, you know, if you have a law that's going to stop people. Well, it never stopped anybody, ever.
It's just about legitimizing somebody that you think should be illegitimate. That's all that is. That's always been my feeling on it. It's like, it's that the resistance to gay marriage is about, well, if your marriage is equal to mine, then my marriage is meaningless or useless because I don't view you with the same respect or legitimacy that I view myself in a heterosexual marriage. You understand? Like, I think that's what a lot of, there's this amazing line or conversation in the movie Mississippi Burning, and that conversation is about race. But Gene Hackman's character tells a story about his dad, and his dad gets jealous of his neighbor who's a black man, and he kills his mule in the middle of the night. And the son looks at him, you know, Gene Hackman is a little boy. He looks at his dad and he knows that he did it. He knows he killed the mule. And he said, well, if I'm not better than that person, then who am I better than, you know? And that is like that same mentality, you know?
That's a really good point.
Yeah.
The other thing I think too is, you know, my dad's relatives went across the country in a covered wagon, right? They did. They went from New York to Illinois, Iowa, around there, both. And, you know, think about a covered wagon, what you could put in there, right? So what would they bring for books? They would bring the Bible. Yeah. You know, that would be it. So this gave them hope and gave them courage to face all these terrifying, terrifying unknowns. And that sort of idea of a fortress, building a fortress of Christianity within your community to protect yourselves from the outside, was really fundamental to, you know, the way even the Puritans coming, you know, on the Eastern Seaboard or Virginia, you know, that whole idea of protecting what you have and believe against the outside, you know, is a crucial part of this. And if the Bible is enough, you don't need any other books. You don't need education. There's a kind of real sense. I mean, I heard this in Illinois, where, you know, in Southern Illinois, where my dad was from, in Indiana, people saying things like, you know, if you know, it's arrogant to want to know more. It's arrogant to want to be educated. My dad didn't want to be educated because he was arrogant. My dad wanted to read because he was so unhappy. Mm-hmm. And it was an escape for him.
Yeah.
What he gained from it is another matter entirely, like looking up and going, oh my God, I knew something was wrong. I just didn't know what it was. And now I see that other people also felt that way, that something is wrong with this.
Yeah.
You know?
It's kind of amazing when the screen comes away from your eyes, you know?
And that's also it, right? Nobody wants the screen to come away from your eyes because they don't want you to know that it's a lie, you know, that the whole thing is a lie.
So do you ever think there will be, I guess the final, we could wrap up with this question. Do you think there'll be a time when people will, like, everything will be okay? Because I always think, like, either all of it is okay or none of it is okay when it comes to censorship. Like, do you think there'll ever come a time where we'll just allow everything in and we just make our own decisions as a market, like what we want to read?
Well, think about what you see in books now and how far we've come in that 50-year period. The problem is, you know, I think, the more interesting question is, you know, Orwell said, you know, in 50 years, they're going to burn the books, you know, whereas Aldous Huxley said, in 50 years, they'll have convinced everybody that they don't need to read. Nobody's going to want to read because there's going to be so much external information coming in. There's going to be so much to keep your mind busy with nonsense that nobody's going to have the time or the inclination to read it. And that's way more dangerous. And I think that is way more dangerous because there are fantastic books coming out all the time. Histories of slavery, histories of the world, of how things ended up the way they are. And most people are too busy on the internet screaming and yelling at each other to really sit down and take the time to read a book.
Yeah. But it's moving in the right direction, maybe.
At least in terms of what is available and out there, the question is then, how do you get people to read?
Yeah.
I think there's a real conscious effort to keep people stupid. I really do.
As a publisher, do you have a line that you like won't, you know, like, I know you probably have dealt with people like come back to you with like, oh, this line in this book is not going to fly well, or this is not going to go over well. Do you have a?
No, for me, it's more language, like specificity of language. Get, you know, what are you trying to say? Is this what you're trying to say? Or is that what you're trying to say? And it's really about word use. what people write about. Of course, I'm interested in specifically the idea of injustice in this country and how people stand up to injustice or overcome their own demons, you know, their own histories, their own demons in order to persevere. So my interest is really more about, you know, how language is used to get the point across. I try to be open-minded, you know, having a kid, really, my daughter opened my mind to a great deal when she was in high school. And I just, there were a lot of things I didn't know. And I learned, you know, that a lot of kids in her school were not, you know, they didn't consider themselves male or female and were somewhere in the middle. And she said, that's normal. And even for my generation, that was hard to get my mind around, that kids might not identify completely as, you know, binary, you know, in this binary system that we have. And, you know, that took me a while to get my mind around that. To her, a young man walking or a young person walking around in a dress and wanting to be referred to as she rather than he, for me was hard to get. To her and to many of the children, the young people in her school, that was fine. And I realized, wow, this is great. We've come a long way. So I think that's what they're trying to stop. You know, I think that's what this is really all about, is stopping the progress of open-mindedness in this country, because you can't control people if they're informed.
Anything else you want to add about that?
I think I said a lot, I think.
Yeah.
I hope I don't get in trouble.
No, I don't think so.
I've been speaking out probably way too much.
Yeah, maybe you could use a little trouble, you know?
Yeah, well.
It's sunny in California. It's too sunny out there.
Exactly.
So, anyway, Kaylee Jones, thank you for coming on and talking to me about this. This is great. And happy birthday to your dad.
Thank you.
All right.
Bye.